It's Friday, and look, we're doing video for our movie reviews, too, for the very first time.
Yeah, we're going to knock out a quick review of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah. We're actually probably going to do another Stanley Kubrick movie. We're probably going to do A Clockwork Orange next time, or the time after, because we were at Target the other day, otherwise known as Target.
Yeah, it's like the French Walmart.
Yeah, and we happened to come across a special edition, like, 3 Kubrick movie set for $15.
Yeah, on Blu-ray.
Blu-ray.
It had 2001, had The Shining on it, which I didn't have that on Blu-ray, and then it had A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that's $5 a movie. I got to get that. So I got it, and we watched them all. And man, that's a good that's a good Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one you should add to your collection if you can find it. You can probably find it on eBay.
Yeah.
I
didn't know. We just happened to see it. We were at Target for something else, and we just happened to come across it. We weren't like looking for it or anything.
Yeah, I was like, whoa.
And it seems like it's a good deal, because all three of these movies, because I love Stanley Kubrick, and all of his movies are super rewatchable, at least for me. I mean, I have seen A Clockwork Orange probably 100 times. I've seen The Shining probably 120 times.
Yeah.
And I never get tired. I could watch it every day.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't get tired.
All three of those movies you can watch every day.
They're very, very rewatchable. No.
Well,
so it was totally, totally worth it.
Yeah, so this one's about 2001. And 2001 is a masterpiece. It's as good as The Shining. I would say that it's The Shining of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think so, too. It's a pretty sophisticated movie. When it came out, a lot of people didn't get it. It was way ahead of its time in many ways. It was a milestone flick. I mean, the special effects are outstanding. The space shots just set the standards. And you can watch it today on Blu-ray, and you're like, man, I have a hard time, you know, believing that this is the 1960s. It looks like real spaceships.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that this came out in 1968, because... Right. I mean, here's the thing. Stanley Kubrick, he's done movies in lots of different genres, but he's always like, whatever story he wants to tell and whatever genre he's doing, he wants to do like the very best thing, or he wants to do something that had never been done before. So at this stage, I mean, this movie came out in spring of 1968. And prior to this, sci-fi wasn't really something that was taken all that seriously. It was just kind of like horror. You know, you just had kind of your big bug 50s movies and that kind of crap.
Yeah.
So this movie was really kind of like a turning point for sci-fi cinema, because this was actually a serious, philosophical, beautifully filmed movie that took itself very seriously. And I think it was really, I mean, later on you can see, and even on the Blu-ray, there's a bunch of interviews with all these directors and stuff that were influenced by this, you know, George Lucas and James Cameron and, you know, all these other kind of sci-fi directors that did all these big sci-fi movies later on. I don't think a lot of these movies would have happened without 2001.
No, this was a game-changing movie.
Oh, definitely.
This movie was taken so seriously that guys from NASA were working on it.
Yeah.
Like, instead of someone having some Hollywood hack, you know, oh, I'll make you a spaceship. Yeah, I'll make you a spaceship. Put a sparkler in it. Now, you had guys who really do design spaceships going, yeah, the Discovery should look like this, you know, and this, you know, the layout of the ship was all planned, and the interiors were all planned. The space suits were made by guys who actually knew what space suits
were supposed to look like
and how it would look in the future, you know. Now, this is 2001 as, you know, as imagined by the 1960s.
Right.
They were looking at it from the viewpoint of, you know, with the rate of innovation they were having in the 60s, they thought that, you know, the progression would lead them to Mars colonies and manned Jupiter missions, you know, by 2001. You know, they didn't really, you know, realize that space had kind of go out of style in the 70s and 80s. But, you know, with the rate of growth that they knew about, then, yeah, a lot of this would be pretty plausible.
Yeah.
And it's funny because they showed a lot of props that they were, you know, conceptualizing for the movie, you know, in the extras. They actually showed a laptop. And their version of a laptop in the 60s was a briefcase that you opened up that had a typewriter in the bottom. I think it had a telephone.
Yeah.
And it had a television screen in it.
Yeah.
And we're like, man, that's a laptop.
Yeah, it was pretty close.
I mean, it was
kind of like an old school laptop. It was a similar kind of thing. A little clunky, but, you know.
But the movie's good. it was kind of known as a head flick in the days. You know, people had a hard time understanding it because the themes were way in advance of even really, you know, I can remember in the 80s not really understanding the movie that well. I liked it, but I was like, what are they
talking about? Yeah, I kind of feel like it's one of those ones where people, I mean, here's the thing. When it came out, it seemed like it was really ahead of its time, sure. Yeah. A lot of critics were kind of like, I don't get it, or they thought it was self-indulgent or boring or something. But then there was like a lot of other, probably half, maybe a little more than half of critics, including like Roger Ebert and stuff, recognized it right away as being a masterpiece and a game-changing motion picture. And then it seems like after it had been out for a little while, they noticed that people were coming in high as balls.
Yeah, trying to figure out this movie.
And trying to figure the movie out. So they started tailoring it more to that audience. And then it seems like it got kind of a cult following later on. Now, I feel like this is not so much, yes, it is a movie, but I feel like it's more of a symphony in three or four parts. And I almost kind of feel like it gives me the same vibe as like Fantasia, if that's not too weird a comparison to make. This obviously has an overarching theme and things that connect its three or four parts together, which Fantasia didn't really have. But it's a similar kind of thing where it's just kind of like a visual feast and there's like classical music and everything is just a spectacle. Yeah. But then there's kind of deeper philosophical issues going on.
Yeah, a lot of people thought that the movie didn't make sense, that it was something just made up. When I was a kid, I asked my dad, I said, Dad, what is this movie about? Ah, it's bullshit. They just made that. You know, it doesn't mean anything. It does mean something. My dad just wasn't really advanced enough to grasp it.
Yeah.
It's like four movies mashed together. They're all interrelated. What happened with Australopithecus like 3.5 million years ago? That's one part of the movie. What happened to a guy named Hayward on the moon in this secret mission? That's another part of the movie. The secret mission to Jupiter. And then Bowman being taken beyond the infinite. It's like four movies mashed together. Yeah. They do make sense. Everything in the movie has an explanation. It's kind of in a way a lot like Prometheus, and but I think in a higher brow than Prometheus.
Yeah,
and Prometheus is
I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that.
Right. Prometheus is hard to understand because there's a lot missing from it. And I think a lot of it was intentionally missing to leave you like in wonder. I really think Ridley Scott was trying to do 2001 with Prometheus.
Oh yeah.
Kubrick does a more effective job of telling you a story and not giving you all the pieces. The pieces are there, but you really have to pay attention, especially when Hal comes in the story. Hal is like one of the main characters through one of the biggest parts of the story. He's an artificially intelligent computer. Who's managing the ship. He's really kind of like the main character, him and Bowman. Even though Bowman's more robotic than Hal, you just got to see the movie to appreciate it. It does make sense. Hal is not malfunctioning, really. He's doing what he's told to do. You find out at the end of that sequence what the deal was. The crew wasn't supposed to know a certain thing. They weren't supposed to understand what the Jupiter mission was about until they got there. So Hal interpreted his orders in a certain way, which back in the day, that really confused a lot of audiences. You know, like, why did the computer go crazy? Well, you're asking an artificially intelligent being to lie. That's the problem.
Yeah, he was supposed to not make errors and not give misinformation, but that was exactly what the humans asked him to do. He was almost like developing neuroses.
Yeah, well, his only way out of this conundrum was to get rid of the crew.
Yeah.
All right. Because the mission had priority. The mission was more important than the crew. All the conflicts in his orders about the crew said, "Well, the best thing I can do is just get rid of the crew, and I'll continue the mission without him."
Yeah.
Because the mission's more important.
Well, because the crew were going to unplug him because he was malfunctioning.
Yeah. Or they thought he was malfunctioning.
From their point of view, he was malfunctioning.
Right.
And so they were afraid that he would sabotage the mission, and he was afraid that they would sabotage the mission.
Right.
So, like I said, the two things were at odds with each other. Now, like I said, this whole thing about, like I said, this is in kind of four parts. Now, the germ of the idea with the monolith on the moon being from the aliens and like helping people along their evolutionary path or whatever, that actually came from the Arthur C. Clarke short story, The Sentinel. And so that was where that idea came from. And then Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick got together and basically wrote this screenplay and novel at the same time, like while it was going on. But I mean, Arthur C. Clarke was working on the book while Stanley Kubrick was working on the thing. So they were working on the screenplay and stuff together. Now, if you read the Arthur C. Clarke book, it's a lot, you know, it's a book, it's not a visual medium, so obviously there's a lot more...
There's a lot more to it.
...made clear in the book that's not made clear in the movie.
Yeah.
But Kubrick said that he wanted to leave the film ambiguous. He wanted a film that was more visual and not so much based on words. There's really not much dialogue in it.
Right.
There's not a lot of sound in it other than music. But he did want... But like I said, you can kind of get... Even with just a really rudimentary viewing of it, you can get that this monolith is an alien technology of some kind.
It's a manifestation of their technology.
Right, that is at different stages of human evolution is coming along and like giving us a little push or like helping us out. You know, 3-4 million years ago, the monolith comes to Earth when we're Australopithecines, and it shows humans how to make tools, which
how
they use
to develop
to make
forward
weapons,
right.
which they use to kind of dominate their environment,
which
and
gives
then,
rise to artificial intelligence,
right?
Which can give rise to beings and or things like the monolith people,
yeah,
because it's inferred that this is a kind of a galactic level. Machine intelligence, but it's beyond that. It's almost a godlike spirit.
Yeah, like a pure energy type of...
Right.
Not even beings, I wouldn't think.
No,
it's almost kind of just like a galactic, like a cosmos level
intelligence. Yeah, it's far beyond a human's ability to comprehend.
Yeah.
In modern terminology, it's probably some kind of a machine intelligence that has evolved into something that's like pure energy... And it's probably not a single individual. It's probably some kind of weird galactic collective. And it's now in the role of nursemaid. It's running a nursery. It's galaxy or group of galaxies. And making sure that life progresses.
Yeah.
Maybe to make more things like it. Mankind
I kinda like that idea, yeah.
Humans and mankind and animals or biology. Life or biological life is not the end result. That's just one of the stages. That's why it does the things that it does. Biology is a certain stage, and then you become kind of trans-biological into living machine energy.
Artificial intelligence,
and then living machine energy.
And then the
energy.
Next stage
the
is...
The next, right.
Just energy, or where... It seems like they almost don't have bodies, I guess,
no.
maybe. So
and I think it's also extra-dimensional, because when Bowman's taken, it seems like he's shown... huge galactic events that are somehow important, different worlds, and then different states of being, possibly other dimensions, and then he's taken to a place where they do to him exactly what you see. You won't understand it unless you read the book, and it's explained later in 2010, the sequel.
Yeah, that does actually kind of explain a lot of
stuff. It explains a lot of what you see. But back in the 60s, people were left hanging. They're like, what the fuck happened?
He's like, what? The space guy is in this weird room? And it's like, then he's old, and
right.
it's like, what the fuck?
And and concepts like biology just being one of the stepping stones in life, that eluded people of the 60s. You know, it just
seemed
did.
Like, and you know...
Well,
like,
my dad couldn't understand it. He loved science fiction, just that he didn't read science. He didn't read science fiction made by scientists. He read, you know, he was into that 50s science fiction, big monsters.
Yeah.
You know,
which I
big
like
animals.
That too.
Right.
But this is, it's almost like less a science fiction movie, as almost kind of like, it's using science fiction as almost kind of like a philosophical treatise, or it's making this kind of allegorical statement about, you know, ancient alien, I guess you can say it was ancient aliens.
Well,
like
this
show.
Is an ancient alien theme. This actually should have been one of the reviews,
that we did about
the ancient
aliens.
We're doing
it now.
It was
only a week or two ago.
Yeah, boy and his dog has interrupted it, but this should have been right there.
And that
with
was sci-fi too.
Because
this
is where that came from. And this movie was a milestone. Without this movie, a lot of science fiction, as you know, it would have never happened. Because the standards were raised up so high with these space shots, you know. This movie actually had corporations and governments, and NASA was involved in this making of this movie. On the Blu-ray, there's in one of the additional bonus features, they actually have a guy, a corporate guy who's involved in aerospace, saying that this movie is going to increase and improve the awareness of civilians, basically, yeah. as he puts it, the public, and make them confront the likelihood that we will eventually meet extraterrestrials, and they will be millions of years advanced, yeah. and that we won't be able to grasp with what they are. That the, you know,
yeah.
you have to look at it from this point of view. Imagine you were a frog that jumped on the side of a car, and then the car started driving, and it started driving down the freeway, and the driver reached out and grabbed you and put you on the dashboard. That frog doesn't know what a car is, doesn't know what a human is, doesn't know what a freeway is. Can see out the front of the windshield and not understand the world as being presented to him in a car going 80 miles an hour. Bowman goes through that when he's taken beyond the infinite, all right, and deals with these extraterrestrials. They're not even physical, all right. Time stops making sense. You'll see when you get there.
Yeah.
He's basically transformed by this, literally, he's transformed by this event.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, there are so many interpretations of this movie, like many of Kubrick's movies, because he always did kind of a mythical
Yeah, there's like
sort of
hidden
thing.
Subtext
but
and stuff.
But he leaves
yeah.
things like ambiguous. Like,
yeah.
you know, like I said, there's, you can read this movie as like a Nietzschean kind yeah. of, you know, thing between the ape and the Ubermensch. Like
yeah,
the, so,
man rising above his environment
yeah, so the
to
man
dominate
is,
it.
Is like
yeah.
the transitional phase between that, yeah. which really does apply. You can also see this as almost kind of like a retelling, like a modern retelling of the Odyssey, you know, with Bowman being kind of the Ulysses figure and with HAL 9000 being the Cyclops. You can see things that way. Because like I said, Kubrick liked to do mythological stuff, like he did in The Shining with... you know, Theseus and the Minotaur and the maze and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of that shit in there. But like I said, Kubrick liked to leave things ambiguous. Arthur C. Clarke kind of clarified things a little bit more, particularly in the book.
Yeah,
and
in the book.
In interviews
the book is really
that,
good, yeah.
that he did later on. But I think Kubrick was more interested in leaving things open to interpretation.
Yeah.
You know, but like I said, I feel like it's a pretty straightforward... Maybe in 1960s, I could see how this could kind of blow your mind.
Yeah.
I feel like people nowadays are more used to the idea of artificial intelligence because we're so much closer to it, are more open to the idea of, you know, alien intelligences and how that's not that far-fetched. So maybe this was just kind of way ahead of its time. I don't think yeah. people would have as much trouble nowadays maybe trying, you know, figuring out what they're talking about. Even the end part with Bowman and the... in the room and everything.
Yeah.
I don't think it's all... That is a super creepy scene. I've seen it's like one of the creepiest things, especially yeah. when they show him standing in the yeah. room with the space suit and he's like older, like his face, and he's like got yeah. this freaky look on
mostly,
his face. That freaks me out.
Mostly in this movie, the way it's portrayed with the sound effects and everything, the way everything's shot, dealing with the monolith is creepy.
Yeah, it's a creepy movie.
Because dealing with an unknown godlike force would be creepy.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I'll help you guys out. Those of you who've seen the movie, haven't seen the movie yet, I've read the book. Really, everything to understand the movie is there. It's in there. All right. You have to read into certain things. All right. But I'll help you along a little bit. In the book, the little Australopithecine characters actually had names and they had roles. And they actually did certain things. And it's explained a little bit better. Man, early man is in the Australopithecine era was getting its ass kicked by competition and predators. The monolith saw the Australopithecines as a group. It was like, well, man, this is the future here, you know, on this planet. So it had selected Australopithecus and certain Australopithecus individuals. And basically, it showed them how to make tools, yes, but it also gave them ambition and it made them killers. They killed their competition. And in the very and from that, they got stronger and they were able to dominate their environment and they could become the dominant species on the planet. And this is illustrated in the movie by the main Australopithecus with a bone. He killed his first enemy. He'd been smashing animals that they were eating to. He throws the bone into the air, and Kubrick shows it spinning through the air, and then it transforms into a bone spinning in through the air, transforms into a nuclear weapons platform in orbit around the Earth, which is the extreme manifestation of technology, of weapons technology, of bone. The weapons technology is what made man leave the planet, become a spacefaring race, and also invent artificial artificial intelligence, which is HAL.
Yeah.
Without that step, other things after man could not appear, could not arise, and it's and this all this high tech stuff arises from the animal kingdom and natural selection, basically survival of the fittest. That's what the movie, and that's why they're playing like Nietzschean music, you know.
Yeah.
That's what they're getting to. Man is not the end result. Man is just one step
along
the way. Right. So we can't put modern moral judgments on what's happening now. This is serving a greater good millions of years from now.
Yeah.
That's what they're talking about.
Like I said, I've always seen this as a very optimistic movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe some, it's very creepy. It's very unsettling. Bad shit happens in it. But ultimately, I feel like it's almost kind of like encouraging. It's like humans, we can transcend our bodies. We can transcend our environments.
Right.
And so I find that very optimistic. Maybe other people don't, but I feel like it's a very optimistic
movie. And that's what's happening at the end of the movie, which mystified me for a long time, when Bowman is taken beyond the infinite. The aliens put him in a place, and they accelerate his biology.
Yes.
So he can transcend biology and become what is shown to you as the audience, a child.
Yeah.
A star child.
The star child.
And the star child is what the aliens turned Bowman into so he could actually transcend biology.
Yeah.
And that comes into play in the sequel. Yeah. 2010, which
we'll have to do that one.
Yeah, that movie's the way that movie's written is very easy to understand. It's very pedestrian, and it kind of explains a lot of stuff that happens in the first one. And the reveal is like when you're like, oh, well, of course, that's what I was seeing.
Yeah,
some of it I've given to you right now, but there's a lot of deeper issues in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, this movie is very Kubrickian. I can see how a lot of people, you know, it's very long. There's not a lot of dialogue in it. A lot of the shots are very, very, they go on for a very long time. And so I can see how maybe if you kind of have ADD and shit, like you wouldn't be able to sit through it. But it's like a visual feast. Like I said, it's almost like a symphonic, like sitting through a symphonic kind of, you know, four movements and stuff like that. So it's just something you kind of have to let wash over you.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a plot. There is a theme.
Yeah. And things don't appear out of nowhere. Right. It's on purpose. That you can even, there's even dialogue to show you when, why, and where the HAL 9000 computer decided to take on the mission on its own.
Yeah.
It's there. Yeah. You just have to pay attention.
Like I said, like all of Kubrick's movies, it's, you know, yes, it's open to interpretation, but he kind of leaves a lot of clues there for you too.
And part of the Jupiter mission almost becomes a horror movie where it feels kind of like the Overlook Hotel with Bowman by himself trying to survive on that damn ship.
Yeah, that is a really, really scary part of the movie.
And he basically has to murder HAL because HAL is a living conscious machine intelligence.
Yeah.
He has to kill it.
Or he might as well be. I mean,
the aliens don't differentiate. Yeah. You'll find later.
Yeah, they don't
need to. But then he finds a message that was left behind that kind of told him what the mission was about.
Yeah.
And that's why HAL decided to knock him off anyway.
Yeah.
You'll see when you get
there. But like I said, the interesting thing about the character of HAL, even though he's the monster of the movie, he's also kind of like the most human character.
Yeah, he's also a hero too. He's trying to do what he was told to do.
Yeah, and he doesn't really know, like, he doesn't understand it. Well, I guess because of his programming.
Yeah, they told him that the mission was the most important.
So he,
and that the humans could not know what the mission was until they got to Jupiter.
And if they found out.
If they found then out.
Then he interpreted that as
well,
I should get rid of them.
And well, especially when they said, well, he's malfunctioning. We got to turn him off. And he's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm more capable than you are when it comes to this mission.
Right.
Because really, if you go by the laws of this movie, the HAL 9000 computer was the next step in human evolution.
Yeah.
That it was our replacement in the evolutionary scheme of things. So it was a superior being. We can't be human-centric.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that too, but
because like, it seems to be that the purpose of human beings was to make things like the Howl and beyond.
Right.
So that's how I.
Although, like I said, there was a little bit of Frankenstein going on there too, where it's like, you know, we made something and it kind of went a bit awry.
But it was human error and how.
But it was human error. It was in his programming, so it was our mistake. But like I said, it wasn't Frankenstein too. It was his mistake thinking that he could usurp. I can make life, which nobody else can do. And, you know, which is a similar thing we talked about a little bit on our Prometheus review, how the whole thing of, like, hubris and making it and stuff. But like I said, it seemed like even though bad shit happened and Hal, you know, killed everybody, it was almost kind of like you said, it was a necessary step on the path to something better.
Interpreting this movie is not a movie of where the universe is seeing us as something that's good or evil. All right, that's not the way the universe is indifferent.
Yeah, and Kubrick has said exactly that.
Yes, the universe is indifferent, and the universe is indifferent about humans. Humans are just one of the phases in this path of development that these extraterrestrials put in motion.
Yeah.
So in other words, in the way I'm looking at it, humans were just one of the steps along artificial intelligence, which eventually leads towards real intelligence, which is these monolith things, this godlike being.
So you're kind of like, almost like one of the steps. You have to do that.
Right.
And then the next step is you transcend your biology altogether and just become like a pure being.
Yeah, it's about transhumanism.
Or
so this whole thing about, well, hey, they made the humans killers. Well, yeah, because without that, then this transhumanism and all this other stuff later on, higher up in the scale of development, that could have never happened because humans are in the animal world. You know what I mean? They're confined to the animal world.
Right. So that had to happen.
For their goal to come to fruition. It's a deep flick.
It is, And like I said, it's, you know, it does help, I guess. I can see why a lot of stoners got into this movie because it is kind of, you know, fun to watch. You get high as balls, you're watching the movie, or you get drunk and watch the movie. It's kind of cool, you know. And like I said, it has scary moments. It has, like, beautiful. It's a really, really overwhelming sensory experience.
It's good. It's
this
good flick.
Movie. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, we'll probably be doing another Kubrick flick either
we'll
on the next
probably
one.
Probably do
after
2010, too.
Yeah,
probably
we're going to have to eventually
that. Yeah.
do that. But probably the next one we'll do is A Clockwork Orange because we got that on. And I've seen that movie a zillion times and I never, ever, ever get tired of it.
But if you can find that Blu-ray, if you can find that Kubrick Blu-ray that has
those
three...
Yeah, we got it at Target. I don't know if that was an exclusive or we weren't looking for it. Like I said, we just kind of happened to see it while we were looking for something else.
Very satisfied with that purchase.
Yeah, it was a really good deal. $5 a piece.
Yeah, and The Shining looks...
And they have tons of extras on them and everything.
And The Shining looks fantastic.
Yeah, we watched that shit again.
Clockwork Orange looks really good. You know, it's good.
I can't wait to do Clockwork Orange. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Look, there's Jenny's Plissken shirt.
Yeah, check
I'll plug the shirt. No,
the back. Thanks, all right.
I still want that in white, but that's still
a
cool shirt.
Well, yeah, I can change the back.
We can change it.
All right, so that'll wrap up our review of 2001, A Space Odyssey from 1968, Stanley Kubrick flick. Check it out if you have not seen it.
Yeah,
it's a classic. You really have to see it.
Yeah.
And remember, if you like the show, to like, share, subscribe on all your social media. Share with all your friends. We're also on some other formats, and I'll put links down in the description to all our different channels and where they are and stuff
BitChute's growing.
And also, if you'd like to financially support the show, you can go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/13oclockpodcast, or you can go to our blog, which is 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com.org. I don't remember. And you'll find it. And there's a link in the sidebar to a PayPal account if you'd like to give a one-time donation. Also, check out our Zazzle store at zazzle.com/13oclock. You can get this shirt and a bunch of other cool ones.
Yeah, Atlanta Ripper.
And a tote bag. Yeah, the Atlanta Ripper one's still kind
Demon of Child. Man said you could.
Yeah. Yeah, man said you could do it. Yeah. So you should. Man said it'd be fun.
Gotta get a Nostradamus shirt.
Yeah, oh shit, I gotta make that a
Keela shirt. Drinking Keela out of a barrel.
Out of a big, big 5-gallon pickle jar. That was wonderful. What a wonderful visual image that was.
Yeah, it was.
And so that will do it for this particular installment. Remember, our regular shows, regular episodes go up every Tuesday, and our movie reviews go up every Friday. And we will see you next time. Bye.